From JetBooks, this is Irish Business Builders, a show about great Irish businesses and the people who built them. Head to jetbooks.ie/resources to pick up our free step-by-step guide on how to automate your bookkeeping.
So very often we're well ahead of the curve with what we do, and you know, sometimes too far ahead of the curve, but it takes a while for the public to catch up. But I think we're very proud of that in terms of the innovation that we have.
I'm Connor Carney, and that's the voice of Peaches Kemp, who together with her sister Dominie started the It's a Bagel restaurant chain back in 1999. Since then, the sisters have built up an extremely successful business across food and hospitality with brands like Joe's Coffee, Hatch and Sons, Alchemy Juices, and Feast Catering. In this conversation, Peaches brings us through the highs and lows of her life in business and gives some really good advice for entrepreneurs who are just getting started on their journey. I started out by asking Peaches about how she first got started in business.
Back in 1999, December of 99, Dominie and I started It's a Bagel. And we really found ourselves unemployed. Both of us had been hugely involved in our other halves' businesses, and we'd split up with them really around the same time. And we'd always worked together back in the early days. I had a small sort of catering, cottage industry catering company. And Dominie was my slave labor. She's 7 years younger than me. So I used to rope her and all of her friends in and work for me. But anyway, we'd always actually wanted to do something together. And so really, I suppose it was personal circumstance that threw us together, funnily enough, at the same time. And we'd spent a lot of time over in the States. You know, we were both born in the Bahamas and I was educated in the States, etc. So we were very familiar, and we'd worked there as well over the years, on and off. So we were very familiar with bagels. And we sort of saw this gap in the market. And the one thing that really stuck with us was that, you know, there just wasn't any decent sandwich around at the time. Mm. And we wanted to do a really decent sandwich. And bagels were the vehicle that we used for that. Mm. So went over to New York, signed a contract with H&H Bagels, who were sort of the best maker, really, of bagels in New York. Very traditional, but they also exported worldwide. And that was, I think, the crunch, what sealed the deal for us going to them. Placed our first order. We got our location over in the Epicurean Food Hall on Liffey Street and placed our first bagel order with H&H, which was 80,000 frozen bagels in a container. That was what we had coming in.
And where did you keep the bagels when you got
them?
We found
there was a place down in the docks, Malloy and Sherry. They have air freeze, and it's a massive, big frozen warehouse. So I knew one of the owners, and I said, "You know, is this something that we could we put them in with you?" And it was like, "Yeah, no problem whatsoever." So and I remember they looked at them coming in and going, "Oh my God, these girls are mad." But also, actually, the funny thing about it was customs had no idea what they were. They didn't know what they were dealing with because they'd never seen them before. So that was a whole another challenge as well, trying to explain to that and to customs officials and stuff like that what this bread product was. And so we got that one sorted out eventually, and and sort of went from there. And really it took a long time for that to take off. It took us about 6 months, and we really were wondering if this was going to work. And then along came Louise East, and in the old Weekender section of the Irish Times, as it used to be just like an insert into the Irish Times. It wasn't the magazine as it is now. And she wrote a half-page article on us. And overnight, we saw a turnover double. We saw it double again within another week. And it just took off. And really? It was just incredible. Yeah, really took off. I think, you know, it wasn't just the bagels. It was the fact that we were making these incredible fillings, combinations. We still are doing the exact same combinations today with a little bit of, you know, variation and doing specials and things like that. But the whole concept, and I think this is the concept, you know, on which we built our business the whole way through, is really good quality food, having that homemade cooked feel to it. Something that's super duper tasty. And as we say all the time, we wouldn't serve a customer anything that we wouldn't eat ourselves. That's our, you know, that's our ethos. That's everything that we do. And it's about quality, and it's about making sure that you deliver a product that is super, that people want to come back for, that they would make themselves, that they feel the trust, I suppose, is that's what it is.
And why food originally? Like we can talk about why bagels in a minute, but you know, why food was that? Well, did you have a background in food prior to that?
Not really. I suppose just always a real interest in it. We're both qualified chefs, and I was supposed to go back to university in the States and did a cookery course here to fill in the time before I was supposed to go back. And then actually decided that I didn't want to go back and stayed here and started working with horses, but also doing the cookery and sort of a bit of a jumbled career as a very sort of as a sort of late teenager in my early 20s. So I suppose it was just a path that came along. And there's always been this huge interest in food from both of us. And we've always had a real interest in cooking, in food, in restaurants, etc. And I suppose it just evolved over time. I think it also probably comes down to the entrepreneurial spirit of wanting to create something, wanting to do something different. I don't think either of us would have ever done very well in a desk job.
Yeah.
And that really kind of is I suppose it's in our nature. So food was the avenue that we went down. It was the entrepreneurial intent as such. And that, you know, that was the avenue that we went down was food.
And did you know that about yourself, you know, that you might not have been suited to a desk job, that you thought maybe the entrepreneurial way was the way that you wanted to go? Did you know that about yourself when you started It's a Bagel?
I don't. Yeah, I think so. So I think it was just that whole thing of entrepreneurs. We don't like being told what to do. We don't like conforming to other people's rules. So, yeah, and Dominic and I would be very much very similar in that way to each other. So, yeah, I think that's it just evolved that way. And I think you either are an entrepreneur or you're not. And, you know, you can become one, but I think it's the degree to which you follow that path throughout your life.
So tell me about the other concepts that you've built out since starting that first It's a Bagel in 1999.
So we went from It's a Bagel. So what we did is after the Epicurean Food Hall, we expanded in 2001 to Dunleary with another Itza. It's a bagel at the time. We've now called it Itza because, as somebody said, if you put the bagel on there all the time, you don't get known for other things as such. Like Costa Coffee became Costa. So it was an interesting thing that somebody said, but that was years later. So did It's a Bagel in Dunleary, again, hugely successful, just took off there. And then that was 2001. So what we found ourselves in at that stage was the Celtic Tiger, and property was crazy, through the roof. Yeah. And it was trying to get access to property. And it was either, you know, you could get a bank loan for millions to buy property. They didn't want to go near you if you wanted to take out a lease. You couldn't get the loans for that. So that was really difficult for us. So our third branch was in Fitzwilliam Lane, which is the lane that runs up the side of the Marion Hotel. Again, little offbeat location, you know, rinky-dink sort of shop that we had there. But again, it was because we couldn't get anything else. Mm-hmm. And then a property came up in 2005, which was in Sandymount. And we'd always wanted to do a restaurant, but the rent was very high there. So we thought, you know, we can't do an It's a Bagel there. It would be, you know, you'd have to sell a hell of a lot of bagels to pay for it there. So we did the restaurant. So that was a leap in a different direction for us. But what that did then is in 2006, Brown Thomas came to us and said, would you be interested in tendering to run our restaurant down in Cork? Which we did. We won, and we're still there. So we started going in different directions than that stage. 2008, we again went in a different direction. And I think it's more about opportunity and what we were able to do. And we've always supported ourselves in terms of we've always gone to the bank for investment. We haven't gone and got investors in. So where we have expanded has been always organically. And it's organic growth, but looking for opportunity that makes financial sense. What we did in 2008 was we started looking at opportunities for tender. So up in the Museum of Modern Art, IMMA, they were tendering for a cafe. We tendered for that. We won that. Still have that. So we started these different concepts. I suppose then what we started doing is looking at different brands or different ways of delivering food. So that was a sort of organic sort of evolvement of, you know, the business as it was. Mm-hmm. We started doing the catering as well because we saw a gap in the market, feast catering. We established that, and that's still going really strongly today, and we're up in Paris Court. And then in the early sort of, then the recession hit. And so, and we were very lucky then because we hadn't become a property company. We hadn't gone and invested loads of money in buying properties. We didn't have a huge amount of debt on our books, et cetera. And that was really hugely important in our survival when that recession hit in 2008, 2009. So around 2010, 11, 12, we started saying, well, you know, and what we found is people were starting to go away from carbs. They didn't really want to eat bagels. Mm-hmm. So we had to look at what else we could offer. It's about reacting to where trends are. It's trying to preempt what trends are and to react to them and put something in place. So coffee was becoming a really huge thing, specialist coffee. That's where Joe's came from. So that was Joe's Coffee. That was opened up in Arnott's. We opened a couple of branches of that. We also went down to Kildare Village and did a Joe's down there. And it was about convenience, great coffees, but convenient sandwiches to go, et cetera. So again, looking at how we could push our whole team to work and to go down different avenues. We also did Alchemy, which actually came out of the back of my sister Domini having been unwell with breast cancer in 2013. And she was looking to do something that was really healthy, that had no refined sugar, no refined, no dairy, no wheat, no anything. So Alchemy came out of that. And that was about cold pressed juices and lunch boxes that were super healthy. So very often we're well ahead of the curve with what we do. And you know, sometimes too far ahead of the curve, but it takes a while for the public to catch up. But I think we're very proud of that in terms of the innovation that we have. And then Hatch and Sons was born really out of, you know, looking at Irish food. And in 2011, 2012, really, I suppose, again, with the recession and where everything had gone and where food producers had gone to, we were starting to see these amazing producers down the country who were doing incredible stuff with food and wanting to take all of that and put it into a concept and deliver something that was truly Irish. So that's where Hatch came from. So that's kind of us and what we continually do with our brands.
I suppose when you're starting these brands and the way they come from, what kind of research do you do? I mean, you saw that obviously coffee was, there was a trend in coffee. You saw, I mean, before bagels, before it's a bagel, I don't know if you could get a bagel in Ireland. As you said, customs might not have been able to see it. Was there ever any question over whether any of these concepts might work when you actually launch them?
Absolutely. So Domini and I have this, we're very lucky because we have this really good relationship where she will come up with all these ideas and I'll ask the question, is that going to work? You know, is that something that's going to fly? I would ask the questions that an investor would ask, you know, how's that going to work financially? How are we going to do it? What's the market demand on it? You know, all those really tricky questions. And I think that's what is the beauty of our relationship, is that we have this balance of, you know, being massively ambitious and looking and being visionary, but at the same time, and she is very much that. She's just like, well, what about this? What about this? And I'm on the other hand going, well, will it work? And what is the financial implications of that? Mm-hmm. And how much, you know, so it is that whole balance. But really with regards to, you know, the concepts, it's, you know, you look to other countries, very much to the States. Australia is where a lot of things come out of. Mm-hmm. Then they go to California. Then they travel across the States to New York. And then they come to Europe. And that really, if you look at food trends, that's so, yeah. And it's much easier now with the internet. But the internet was there, you know, back in sort of the early part of this, of the last decade as well. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it is about doing that research and seeing what's out there. Now, though, things are so much faster because of Instagram, because of everything, like everyone's seeing everything everywhere really quickly. Yeah. So the reaction time has to be that much faster. But I think you also have to be really careful of not being the busy fool that jumps at every single concept that comes along, because you can get so distracted. So I think it's about targeted, focused markets, and longevity, I think, is really important.
This podcast is produced by JetBooks, an online bookkeeping service dedicated to giving you real-time financial information at the click of a button. Head to jetbooks.ie/resources to pick up our free step-by-step guide on how to automate your bookkeeping. When it comes to that financial part that you mentioned, what goes into your thinking around that? I suppose profitability, it's a low enough margin business, the restaurant business, or it can be at least. What do you look at when you're kind of analyzing one of these ideas?
there are so many things that you're looking at. You know, the biggest costs that we have are wages. They're, you know, off the charts, and it's and it has become really difficult in recent years to get good people, because the market is, there are so many food concepts and so many restaurants, etc., pre-COVID that were out there. So getting good quality staff, if you wanted them, you're paying through the nose for it. Then you're looking at your location, you're looking at your rent, all those sorts of things. And then, you know, your food costs are hugely important, but that's not your margin. And that's easy enough, but, you know, to determine. It's the others that have the stealth-like creep on into your finance. And that is, you know, what we found over the years. And it's, you know, if you have an ops team, which we do, you know, that's another layer of cost on top of it. So you have to be kind of brutal about things. And, you know, look, we've learned over the years by not being ruthless, you know, it does cost you financially, and you won't be as profitable. You do have to look at those things. So those are the first things that I would look at is, you know, what are the wages going to be? What sort of team do we have to put in there? How much support are they going to need? And then looking at rent is a huge one. You know, it really is. And it's, people think, oh, no, that'll be fine. And if I'm doing, you know, 750,000 and, you know, blah, 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 and I'm, you know, 75 grand rent, you know, it's only 10%, et cetera. But it's amazing. You've got rates and you've got all the other charges that are in there. And you have to look at all those things, all those stealth costs that are in there that add up. So a really focused view of every single little cost chips away at your EBITDA. And I think you have to focus on those.
Did you learn that since opening the very first location, or did you have a background in that prior to opening the first one?
Learned as I went. Yeah. And I'm still learning, you know, and that's the thing. And I think we all do. None of us know everything. I think if you think that you know everything, you might as well retire or, you know, stop, because constantly learning about things and constantly learning better ways to do things. But we're really naive when we opened up, but we were also very lucky that we had a concept that worked, because I think, you know, had it not worked, we were going to be in a lot of debt, you know. And we used our own money, you know. I mean, you know, Dominie had sold a house, and so, you know, we were able to take the proceeds of that and put it into the business. So that would have been a big personal hole in our pockets if it hadn't worked. So
do you think it is helpful to be a little bit naive when starting a business?
Yeah, I suppose really, if you say naive, I suppose it's really not knowing all the pitfalls. Yeah, because then you'd never jump off the cliff. You know, opening up your own business is jumping off a cliff and trying to figure out, I think it was Reid Hoffman said it, it's jumping off the cliff and learning how to build the plane on the way down and hoping you do. And then halfway down, having others join you. And more often than not, you hit the rocks at the bottom. But then I think it's to go back up to the top of that cliff and jump off again. And yes, it could be the definition of insanity, but also it is what entrepreneurs do. We constantly jump off that cliff and try and figure out better ways to build the plane on the way down. And I think that's it. So I think naive, I wouldn't say is good, but I would say that you've got to be brave. There will be always things that you won't know when you start off. And that's fine. And you will learn those. And it's not to feel like you failed if you discovered something further on down the path that you didn't know or didn't understand. Not to beat yourself up and go, oh God, I should have known that. No, you wouldn't have known that. Your experience has told you that. And the next time you do it, you'll do it better. Mm-hmm.
What have you found have been your strengths over the years? Have you discovered more about yourself throughout the whole process?
God. That's like an Oprah question.
Yeah. No, I fancy myself as a bit of an Oprah.
God, no. I've learned to be more patient, more tolerant. Really, I suppose, to not beat myself up when things do go wrong. But also what I've learned is that you can't be a one-man band. You've got to rely on your team. You've got to really build a really good, strong team around you. My dad said that to us when we were very young, actually. And you always think your parents are fabulous, your dad's great, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, he said, no, he said, you know, I'm good at my job, but I surround myself with really good people. And that stuck with me. And that's, you know, we're talking 40 odd years ago, he would have said that. So that has always stuck with us. And we're very lucky that we have a good team. And, you know, and I think it's things that I've learned is to nurture team, to bring people along with you, to create that, to lead and to lead by example, to treat people the way that you would want to be treated yourself. And that creates loyalty. And I think that's the one thing that I'd say, that we're very lucky that we've got a very loyal team and a very close-knit team.
Has it helped having a partner in business?
Hugely. It's something that I would say, we've been very lucky having each other, because we're sisters, we're friends, we're business partners. And yeah, we scrap like cats every now and again. But the great thing about it is we're terribly close, and family is all important for us. And so we do this for the betterment of family, to look after each other, but also, as I said, to look after our team and to create livelihoods for our team. You know, that's really, really important to us. And integrity is a huge part of what we do. So it's not just about making loads of money and, you know, going off on fancy holidays. It's about making sure that the people that, you know, work with us have a really good quality life as well, a good quality of life. So having that partner is really great, because it's hugely supportive. You also thrash things out and you get to the bottom of what's really the good idea or the bad idea. And we always say that out of every argument comes, you know, a better understanding and a better way forward. And I think, you know, the good times, it's great to share the successes. There's nothing like it. The bad times, there is nothing quite like being able to be there for each other. And I think especially during these times, these COVID times, where our business has been hit so hard, to be able to turn to each other on certain days and all the way through. And certainly, you know, the difference of the two lockdowns. The first lockdown, you know, it was just, it was so unknown, and it was so, you know, it was so terrifying and what the future held. This one is, there is frustration of wanting to open back up. But during both of them, but especially I think in the first one, the support mechanism for each other, it was so important in keeping us going. And there would be days when one of us would just, you know, be struggling, that the other one would pick them up and push them along. And I think what's really important, and what Dominie and I do, is we say it to each other. We say, I'm having a bad day, or I'm really struggling. And we do that. And, you know, I've been out walking the dog in the park. I've called her and I said, I've had a really bad day. I'm really struggling with this. And she's like, great. Okay, well, look, I'll take over. You look after yourself. So it's that whole thing of being kind to yourself, being, you know, minding each other. But I would also say it is not the be all and end all to have a partner. Mm-hmm. We're lucky that we get on so well, but I don't think you should have a partner for the sake of having a partner. If you can't have that partner, get the mentor. Partnerships are, you know, they're very delicate things. They can go wrong. And God knows we've all seen that go wrong. Things go wrong for people. So, as I said, don't do it just for the sake of doing it.
You mentioned your dad earlier on, and obviously your sister Dominie has been a good support, as you've just talked about. Has there been other people that you've looked to, mentors or anyone like that, that you've gotten advice from over the years?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're very lucky. We were nominated in the EY Entrepreneur of the Year program in 2011. And so we became part of that community. And that's something that I've really stayed very much in touch with. I've been chair of the board until for the last 3 years. That is where I would say that so much of the mentoring has come from, because what it is it's entrepreneurs sharing their experiences. It's a very unique community of like-minded individuals who've gone through the ups and downs of starting a business, seeing it fail, going again, and then eventually that success comes their way. And even though the success has come their way when they've been nominated and they've become part of the community, some of them have subsequently failed. And what I've seen in that is this incredible support network that we have for each other. And so out of that, I would say that I've learned more from being part of that community in the last 9 years than I would have in the 11 years prior to that of being in business. And the lessons of, you know, having the mentor. And yes, we subsequently went out, and not necessarily to find mentors, but mentors suddenly sometimes just present themselves to you. You find that person who has that wisdom, and then you can make that connection. And sometimes, you know, we will go and seek somebody out because we've heard about them, etc. But also, you know, taking financial advice, you know, and from our financial advisors, listening to all of that, from other people who have been in similar businesses as well. So I think mentorship is hugely important. And as I said, that community was instrumental in really enforcing that message.
Since starting with It's a Bagel, why have you never scaled out any of those concepts to a huge size? I mean, you talked about longevity. It's a Bagel is still there. So there's obviously longevity in that particular concept. Have you ever thought about franchising or scaling out one particular concept?
Yeah, in the early days, we were approached actually for somebody to buy into It's a Bagel and to scale it. And what they proposed, you know, you could probably say that it was but naive, you know, on reflection or wasn't ambitious enough. But we felt that what they wanted to do with the brand was not in line with what we felt about the brand. So, and it was going to be, they wanted to do it on a massive scale, and that's great. But I think sometimes when you do that, you lose the quality. And certainly with franchising, you know, it's a tricky one. And we certainly felt that about, we did look at the franchising route. But again, it's about having people who are going to look after your brand, because when you start expanding like that, you do lose a bit of quality and you don't have the control over it. And maybe that's just showing that we're total control freaks. But at the end of the day, I think it's always been about not wanting to put all our eggs in one basket. Now, at the same time, you can dilute yourself too much. And there have been times when, you know, we've gone for different concepts and they worked, but they haven't really got the traction. So, you know, so that has diluted down our focus. So certainly, you know, we're at a stage where we're refocusing everything to see what is and what isn't working. I think COVID makes you look in the mirror, in your business mirror, and see what's going on. So, you know, that would be probably what I would say is has been to a certain extent the only benefit of COVID is you have time to reflect, et cetera, instead of just keeping, you know, running along on that treadmill. So the temptation has been there to expand, etc., and it's not something that I would discount for the future, but done in the right way, because I think sometimes that massive expansion, bigger is not necessarily always better. And I think people think, oh, you know, do 100 of them. And this is like, yeah, but you know what? Look at Jamie's in England, you know what I mean, in the UK, like disaster, you know. So some of those ones that took a concept that was super successful at a grassroots level and went and expanded it hugely, absolute financial, you know, Armageddon. So yeah, I suppose we'd always be cautious, cautiously optimistic, but cautious, but ambitious still.
What do you think is the biggest mistake you've made over the 20 or so years since starting out?
I mulled over this one, actually, I have to say.
it's a tricky one.
Yeah, this is one of those questions that I was going, oh, jeepers. Okay. Yeah, it's a hard one. I think what I would say is have a really good shareholders agreement and a really good constitution, because we found ourselves in a situation with other shareholders and something that started off wonderfully in a separate entity as such, that we did many, many years ago that went pear-shaped in terms of the relationship. And the result, as I said at the time, you know, the minute the lawyers get called in, everyone's lost. And it was one of the lessons that I learned is get that. And Dominy and I have it ourselves in terms of a really rock solid shareholders agreement that we signed up for that and established that back in 2000. We had it. And it was, you know, it so the basically, if we were going to divorce, it was going to be so, it makes it so hard for us to split up, because the onus, the financial owner, you know, obligations are so enormous, the implications. So, yeah, I would say that, you know, and thinking that everything would be rosy in the garden, it wasn't, and it cost us dearly in terms of energy, money, etc., and to what end. So, yeah. That I would say is biggest mistake probably is just not having the foresight to make those early decisions, as we say, prepare for the divorce before you get married.
It's an easy mistake to make, though. You do hear about a lot of entrepreneurs in the early days, maybe signing agreements or signing up to things that eventually cost them big time. And there probably was no way they could have really known unless they had had a, you know, a solicitor or someone like that look at it prior to the arrangement.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I think the thing about it is that you, in the early days, everything was, you know, everyone's super excited, everyone's really enthusiastic, everyone's getting on. It's just like, oh my God, we've got this incredible concept, and wow, and, you know, what the future can bring. And so you get caught up in that excitement, etc. And you can't see, it's kind of like love in a marriage.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah,
you
yeah.
see all the good in each other. And, you know, you don't see 5-10 years down the line and you can't stand each other, you know, or, you know, so, you know, what you saw in the person when you married them might not be the person in 10 years time. So it's the exact same concept. And it's not to be, you know, a doubting Thomas and cynical your whole life. But be realistic and be, as we say, plan for the divorce and, you know, make those decisions at an early stage. Get those things down that it's very clear, because it just makes life much easier if the worst happens further down the road.
Is it difficult to run all this kind of multitude of businesses? How is it actually run from the top? I mean, what are your days like, and what do you spend most of your days doing?
In normal times?
Yeah.
In normal times, and funny enough, I've been even, you know, we're still busy and planning for the future as it is, even while we're shut down. But certainly on normal days, it's Dominic and I take very much divisions of the business. We're both responsible for different branches, for different, you know, the different certain different brands. There is no crossover there. It's just like, you're running that, that's your responsibility, and I'm running over here. We have a team, the ops team underneath us, so we use them. The same communication, I think, is key. So, you know, it would be up early in the morning. You know, my desk is at home. I don't work from the office, because I find when I'm up there, it's like Grand Central Station. People are just coming in constantly talking to me, so you get nothing done. Mm-hmm. So certainly COVID has been fine for me, because I was already working, doing my office work from home. Mm-hmm. So it's about dealing with those emails, things that are coming in overnight. And then, you know, I would have a full schedule of, you know, going around to shops, meetings, meeting with concession partners, with customers, etc. And then very much planning for, you know, Feast, as I said, which is the catering division, is one of my my responsibilities. And there's an awful lot to that. So that's dealing with a team who are very separate to our ops team, who are looking after brides, couples, brides and grooms, couples, corporates, etc. So it's no 2 days are the same. We do tend to work, you know, I suppose we're on duty 7 days a week, but we do try and take, you know, when we can take the weekends off. But very often we'll be working the weekends, certainly on a Saturday. So, if, you know, I'll try and take maybe a day somewhere else and have a round of golf. But yeah. That's few and far between these days, and even up and even pre-COVID as well. So, so a real division of duties, but also a huge amount of communication between myself and Dominic. We do an awful lot by email, and we track everything by email as well. So, and then ops meetings, management meetings, etc. So it's constant.
Have you found over the years that you've noticed any weaknesses in yourself that you try and now stay away from, or how have you dealt with those?
When you're saying weaknesses, what?
Yeah, I mean, some people would have a weakness maybe on the financial side, or maybe on the operations side, or marketing. Is there any area of the business that you're not that comfortable with that you leave maybe to your sister or to the operations team?
I hate IT. Terrified of it. It's just like, oh my God, I'm a dinosaur when it comes to computers or anything IT related. Just run a mile.
Yeah, something you stay away from.
Yeah.
So you mentioned a bit about the pandemic already and the lockdown. How has it affected the business overall, and what's your outlook for next year?
It's had a huge effect, needless to say, because we're all but shut down, except for one branch. Dunleary is open for takeaway only at the moment, but we are still able to do small weddings of 25. That's still going, which is great, and will continue to. And I just hope the numbers do expand for 2021. At the moment we're planning and hoping and praying for some sort of reopening in December, because I think that is essential. You know, not just for us, but for the entire industry's survival. You know, I think that I won't get into my opinions on COVID. This one, which are rather, we could go in a whole nother direction.
Strong feeling,
Absolutely. I do think that, you know, the fact that they've come up with a couple of vaccines that have massive efficacy is hugely encouraging and definitely something to look forward to. I think it's going to take us a while to get back to where we were. What we did see is that when we reopened from sort of the end of June until September is that the city centre is like a ghost town. So all those locations, you know, we're looking at what we do with those. How do we reinvent the wheel? Because offices, office workers, just, you know, when are they going to come back, if ever? So, you know, people are talking about 3 days in, 2 days at home. So, you know, and then tourists, of course, as well, are a massive part of the city centre. So so looking to see when travel returns as well. But one thing that I, you know, read and that people have said is that very often after sort of a huge pandemic like the Spanish flu and back in the early part of last century, you know, along came the roaring 20s. Humans have a huge capacity to recover and to go back to what they were doing before. And I heard it at the start of the pandemic, actually, and it was a really encouraging thing. And it was, I think it was a UN worker who had gone to many war-torn countries over his years with the UN. And he said what he saw time and time again was as peace came to a region that they had been war-torn, as the armored tanks were leaving out of the village, were going out of the town, at the bottom of the town, at the top of the town, the stall trader, the street trader was wheeling his stall of oranges in at the top of the town and taking up his place again where he had been before the war. So I just thought that was incredibly heartening. And something to remember about human resilience that, you know, we're in the middle of all of this and we're so sometimes helpless because of what this has done to us. But it's to look to the future and to remember that we will recover and there will probably be a real bounce in that recovery. So that's what we will look to. We're not going to sit there going, oh, it's going to happen, you know, tomorrow, the next day. No, it's going to happen in months and maybe, you know, a year, year and a half down the line. But it will happen because that is human nature, is to want to recover and get back to the life that we like and we enjoy and that we knew before. So, yeah, so I suppose that's where I'm looking with the business, is that there is definitely light at the end of the tunnel. It's just about continuing on in that tunnel for a while.
I think that would be a very positive note to finish on. Peaches Kemp, thank you very much for joining me on the podcast.
It has been a pleasure, Connor. Thank you very much.
This podcast is produced by JetBooks, an online bookkeeping service dedicated to giving you real-time financial information at the click of a button. Our team of qualified accountants leverage the power of cloud technology to automate your manual processes and cut the cost of your finance function in half. Head to jetbooks.ie/resources to pick up our free step-by-step guide on how to automate your bookkeeping. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and leave a 5-star review. It really helps others to find the show. I'm your host, Connor Carney. Thanks for listening.